Hey everyone, welcome to the fourth episode of the NISA podcast, The Unmentionables. I'm Mia Clark, co-founder of NISA, a new women's wellbeing company dedicated to supporting parents through their fourth trimester. In each episode, we interview either an expert working in the field or we share parents' first-hand stories and uncover some of those unmentionables that many of us experience postpartum but don't necessarily talk about. This is a place to share information, resources, and real stories so that we can help shine a light on what really goes down. Because we can promise you that whatever shape your fourth trimester experience takes, you're not alone. On this episode, we talk to Lauren Smith Brody, the founder of the Fifth Trimester Movement, and author of the book, The Fifth Trimester, The Working Mum's Guide to Style, Sanity, and Big Success After Baby. Prior to writing her book, Lauren had a 16-year career in magazine publishing, most recently as the longtime executive editor of Glamour magazine at Condé Nast, where she also produced the Woman of the Year awards. I was so excited to talk to Lauren as I found her book incredibly helpful as I prepared to return to my job at the start of last year. It's full of practical advice about everything from pumping at work to choosing your postpartum work wardrobe and getting emotionally ready to leave your baby. And for those of you living outside of the US, this is one of only two countries in the world where it's legal to provide 0 days maternity leave to new mothers. If you're very, very lucky, you might get about 3 months leave, the majority of which is still often unpaid. That's what I had, and as you'll hear about in our conversation, it was absolutely not long enough. One of the many things I love about Lauren's book and her continued advocacy work for new parents in the workforce is that she challenges the stereotype of the frazzled new mum struggling to have both a career and a baby, and she champions the fact that new mothers are actually fantastic workers and that our experience of early motherhood can actually set us up to be even more flexible, strategic, and creative thinkers and doers. Check her out on Instagram at the Fifth Trimester for more of her insights and work in the field. Okay, Lauren spoke to us from her home in New York City. Let's get into it.
So hi, Lauren. We're so excited to speak to you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on. Happy to be here.
Your book had a really profound personal impact for me as I was preparing to return to work at the start of last year following 3 months of maternity leave from the brand agency mm-hmm. I was working at the time. Mm-hmm. So I read your book at night and I listened to the audiobook during the day. You know, I must have gone through it, you know, four times before I
oh my God.
Book. And I went back to that first day feeling so prepared. I had been thinking about all the things I wanted to do at work, and I invested in a haircut and a new outfit and spent some really lovely quality time doing extra special things with my daughter during those, you know, that kind of week prior to returning, which is something you recommend, you know, doing in your book. And so I went in feeling really jazzed and ready to go, and then I totally and utterly crumbled. And the next day I went to my supervisor and I tried to quit. And thankfully she was a mother as well. And she understood, and we, you know, we worked through it. She's like, you're not allowed to quit on your second day. We can talk about this.
Later. Smart woman.
Right. And things improved dramatically from there. And I was able to kind of find my groove with that new work and family dynamic. But that first day back was really one of the hardest of my life. And I'm curious, is that, you know, I want to quit kind of attack something that you've heard about from a lot of women, and what are your recommendations for really processing those intense emotions in that moment?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I recall, you know, I mean, in, you know, painful, like, you know, like sun-drenched detail, that feeling of that first day of leaving my baby in, you know, a virtual stranger's arms. I had known our caregiver for 2 days, you know, and walking away. I call it actually the second cutting of the cord, because it really, only this one actually hurts. It has nerve endings for mom. and heading back was really challenging for me. And I found that, I definitely had that kind of blip of a moment of how on earth is this going to work? I have to quit. I was actually, in some ways, quite fortunate that my husband was just starting his medical training. So my income, you know, had been, I was the primary breadwinner. We needed my income. And so there wasn't, I don't want to call it a luxury being able to quit, because, mm-hmm. you know, heavens knows, like, you know, American women in particular just need more support around new motherhood, the return to work, et cetera, et cetera. That's like my whole premise.
Totally.
But for me, I kind of couldn't even consider it. And that was terrifying, because, you know, somehow this was going to have to work. And I was pretty sure that what I was going to be robbing from was myself. I did find, you know, years later, I stayed in my job. I found a lot of solace in kind of redefining what success looked like, and also redefining just what satisfaction in the workplace looks to me. I found a lot of comfort in being able to mentor other women in a way that I really hadn't felt I could before, and in being a role model, both for, you know, getting through the transition back to work and also for being a mess and being kind of open about it and getting through it anyway. It's kind of, I'm a very open booked person and very, you know, I kind of wear everything on my sleeve. And I was lucky to be in a position of privilege and to have, you know, a supportive spouse and a job that paid pretty well and pretty supportive bosses. And also just to be in a workplace where I could be probably a little bit more open than maybe other women could in theirs. I worked at a women's magazine, Glamour magazine. And so we were really comfortable talking about things like nipples, you know,
that really
helped. But anyway, so I stayed for several years, had my second son, found a lot of new, you know, redefinition around what success looks like and having a hard stop to the end of my day. And God knows I did not get it right every day. But years later, I decided that actually what I had been through was really just a transition for me. You know, the first three trimesters are pregnancy. The fourth is the fourth trimester, you know, sort of that notorious newborn phase where you just get through it. And the fifth trimester, there weren't really any resources for it, but I was like, you know what, I'm going to trademark that, the fifth trimester, because there definitely is one. And having gotten to the other side of it, there's a lot I learned through the transition that I knew that I could both pay forward to other moms who were coming up, you know, behind me, but also that I had gained in real career skills and, you know, perspective and, you know, life balance skills, certainly, that I was going to use throughout my entire career. So I went on to interview and survey hundreds of other moms to figure out how they made it through and to see the things that we had in common and the things that were different. And I will say, you know, in doing this was all research that led me to leave my job and go write this book, The Fifth Trimester, and turn it into a business as well. And in interviewing them, I looked for a real diversity of experiences, of approaches to motherhood, of approaches to career. There were hourly wage workers I interviewed. There were, you know, women who worked for Fortune 500 companies. What I kind of didn't think about going in is that I was going to also see a diversity of ambition. And that ambition really knew no bounds. Of education level, of you know, how well people were paid, the kinds of work they did. There were incredibly ambitious waitresses who I talked to who banded together their colleagues to figure out how to divvy up tips more equitably, you know, when you had a new mom in the mix who perhaps couldn't, you know, carry as many trays at a time. And then there were a lot of women who were super, super educated and who didn't have who experienced, you know, just that like crushing feeling of, oh God, maybe I'm not as ambitious as I thought. So all of these women, every single person I talked to had at least a moment of that moment that you described, you had of, this isn't going to work, I have to quit.
Right.
And yet I knew that, you know, for most people who would be reading this book that I was making, that not working was not an option. You know, we know that most families in America right now are dual income families, and that I think it's the statistic is that 42% of households have either women as a sole or primary breadwinner. And so really the only option is getting through it and staying in and making change from within. So that is a really long answer to your question, but yeah,
no,
everybody
great.
Had that feeling of like wanting to quit, and yet a lot of people were able to get through it. And so I wanted to figure out what did they have in common working for them, against them, that could help other people.
Yeah.
Lauren and I talk quite a bit about matrescence. And for those listeners who haven't heard the term before, it refers to that profound hormonal and emotional shift that new mothers experience postpartum, which isn't dissimilar in magnitude to what we go through in adolescence. All new mothers experience matrescence to varying degrees. And of course, going back to work yields its own challenges to our sense of identity, because the you that's going back into work after having a child is not the same you as before. So I asked Lauren what she thinks some of the most effective strategies are for mothers and fathers returning to work. How can we be kind to ourselves as we move through this period of change?
I mean, I could, like, you know, I wrote 352 words of a book to answer that question.
Right.
I have so many ideas that I've learned, you know, not just from my own experience, which is limited, but from all of these other women who have shared theirs. I will say, you know, having now developed into a business where I've gone in and talked to, you know, large groups of parents and also large groups of managers, I love the Q&A at the end, because I end up, you know, just with so many ideas that are beyond my own experience and even beyond the 800 women I talked to for the book. And so I've applied a lot of what they've learned. And I will say, you know, a takeaway that I have after almost every single speaking engagement I do is that it really starts at home. Yeah. You know, this is obviously, if you are a single parent, like, you know, God, more power to you. I am in awe of what you are able to manage and do. For those of us who do have a partner in the home, you have to rely on that person as a resource. As best you can, you know, split the nighttime wake up. There's all kinds of research and data that actually shows that it is beneficial to your partner's relationship with your child, even into their teenage years, if they do the wake up. If you both have access to parental leave, really push your partner to also take parental leave. Some of it can be overlapping, but it's actually incredibly beneficial. If you yourself don't have access to more than 3 months, and we know that most women do not, to tack your partner's leave onto the end of yours, to get your baby to be a little bit older before they're in the care of someone else. It just shows that it's protective of baby's development. And not to say that anybody's baby is unsafe in anyone else's care, because my God, you just do what you have to do.
Yeah.
But you know, if you can extend that time, it helps baby get older. And then of course the added benefit is that your partner learns on the job what perhaps you have been mostly managing in the home. And then at the end of the day, when you're both back at work and you're both coming home at the end of the day and you walk through that door, you both know how to do all of the things, or you have a more equitable division of labor.
Yeah, I love that.
And then that actually translates directly into the workplace. You know, we know that when dads take, and I don't mean to be binary about it, but the study was on dads. When dads, for every month of paternity leave a dad takes, mom's earnings increase by 7%. And I think that is because dad learns how to pull his weight at home, which, by the way, he totally wants to. And also because he's sending a message in his workplace that his work is not necessarily worth more. Because when dad takes less leave than mom, it really does perpetuate the wage gap. It just sends a message internally in the home, externally at your workplace, or your husband's workplace, partner's workplace, that men's work is worth more, and it's not.
I really, really love that. Like, not only the impact that it has in the workplace as people, you know, see, you know, fathers taking the stand, but also creating, being able to like really have a deep sense of empathy for what the mother has been going through and share that labor.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. This is not just about dad being able to diaper a baby. This is about mom trusting that dad can make decisions with the same love and care that she does for this child. And that is something that you will feel and model for your children, by the way, as they get older. My kids are now 7 and 10. And so much of what, you know, we do in our home to divide up that labor is not just to make things fair between us, but also to set an example for our kids.
Exactly. Yes. Totally. And actually on this, you know, on this vein, am I right that it's been proven that mothers' salaries tend to decline after having a baby while fathers actually go up?
Yes, that is absolutely true. So it is, it's called, there's a term for it. It's called the motherhood penalty, which is the measurable impact of parenthood on a woman's earnings and her status in the workplace. So the figure that is cited is that, and this is the kind of, there's a lot of research out, and this is the most conservative figure, is that for every child, your earnings decrease by 4%. And just to be totally clear, because that's something that people like to talk about a lot, but you have to really understand that when this study was done that found this, they actually compensated for perhaps mom's working less hours, or mom, you know, not having the support she needs and being, you know, as active in her role as she was before. They accounted for all of that. And even accounting for that, she makes 4% less.
Wow.
When moms are interviewing for jobs, they are offered jobs, they're offered salaries that are 8% less than women who are not mothers, and it's 9% less than men. There's also a measurable impact on, this was a study from Harvard, on mom's perceived competence in the workplace and dedication in the workplace, when in fact there's a whole other slew of studies that actually show that mothers are in several ways actually more effective and more financially beneficial workers when you come back to work after baby. It's astounding, and it's clearly just a cognitive, it's all based in cognitive bias. Which is something that we can work hard individually to correct in a small way in our own little workplaces, and have real impact.
It's also, you know, it's not uncommon for new mothers maybe to think about shifting from working full-time, right, to working part-time after having a union. That's not always necessarily a solid option, right, because women often end up working full-time anyway while they're being paid part-time, right?
Right. Well, so that's actually when you talk about the, when people ask me about the motherhood penalty and they ask my recommendations, you know, there are a lot of things that I have learned just in these past couple of years of doing this work. And I would have thought originally, well, if you're working a 4-day week, you should be paid for a 4-day week. Absolutely. Go into them and say, I'll work for 80% pay. Well, in reality, you know, if you work, say, a shift job or you work something where your work hours are very clearly defined, I think that that does actually make sense. However, if you are going to be, you know, on your day off working, you should be paid for that. Or if you're going to be cramming 5 days of work into 4 days of work, if you are still delivering full-time deliverables on your job, you should be paid for that. Don't give yourself a pay cut, you know, just because you think that's going to be what gets you what you want in terms of flexibility. You should go into any kind of negotiating conversation with a case made, not just for why this is good for you, but why this is good for your company. And some of what you can do is you can cite some statistics about flexibility and about the efficacy of offering flexible work arrangements, you know, in terms of time and in terms of the location you're working from. There's a lot of research that shows that we're actually more productive when we have that flexibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 100% agree. And what about women who are self-employed? Because this is a tricky spot to be in, right? Because you have that pressure to, you know, start earning again, you know, probably like, you know, ASAP. And what are your tips for sort of navigating life self-employed, especially if you're working from home where the baby may be or may not be, but that kind of mayhem of, you know, life with babies certainly is. The laundry and all of that.
The hardest of the hard is working for yourself and having a new baby and not having childcare. I learned, you know, I said that I learned to check some of my biases as I was doing my research. I have to tell you, like, I went into researching this book thinking every woman deserves at least 3 months of leave. You must demand it. And then I started interviewing women who work for themselves, and guess who they can't demand it of?
Right.
Themselves. And they feel real pressure to be there. You know, that most of them are in client driven, you know, businesses. And some of them had to hide the fact that they were expecting entirely, which feels so antiquated.
Wow.
And yet actually for them to maintain their businesses, they had to do that. I interviewed, I can think of, you know, three right off the bat, and I'm sure there were more women who told me that they were working on their first day after having a baby, in part because they were just trying to, you know, just trying to tread water to make sure their businesses were sustainable. If you do work for yourself and you have a team of people, by all means, spread out what you've got to do among that team. Don't expect somebody to step in and be you, because they're never going to be. But if you know someone, if part of your job is balancing the books and you know that, you know, someone on your team is particularly good at that, give them that piece of it. If part of your job is, you know, client relationships and, you know, building, you know, potential new client relationships, and someone on your team is good at that, give that piece to them. Everybody can handle taking a little piece, and you may find that they actually grow into that in a way that frees you up eventually to do things that are kind of, you know, at a higher pay grade, and that actually lets you do more bigger picture thinking. And get out of some of the muck of the sort of, you know, the lesser paid skills that a lot of women take on, you know, even at later points in their careers.
Yeah.
That, of course, assumes that you have a team of people, which is, I will tell you, I work for myself. I am speaking to you right now from my home office.
Right.
So I don't have that. I've had to kind of just learn as I go. And a lot of it is about giving yourself, being as good a boss to yourself as you would hope someone would be to you. So yes, you may not be able to take, you know, a 3 month or even, you know, a 6 month, which is really the humane amount of time, leave. However, you may be able to carve out sacred times in your day when you do not work. You may be able to, you know, band together with other women who are in the same situation and start to think of them as your colleagues and your work wives, because they're going to need the same thing too. And you can pinch hit for each other, because there's going to be one call, you know, you're going to be on a podcast, you know, and not be able to actually have the little kid noise in the background, you know, as much as it may be on brand for me. You know, I'm lucky my kids are at school right now. But, you know, so really cultivate relationships with sort of faux colleagues as much as you can. There are a lot of women who draw boundaries of time that work for them. Everybody works in a different way, but I interviewed one woman who was a medical transcriptionist who simultaneously ran an in-home daycare because she had a child with special needs who she lived in a town that did not have any daycares that had appropriate resources for her child. And so she did it herself. And then while she was doing it, she took in a couple of the neighborhood kids as well because she needed the income. And she literally took a piece of tape and she put it around, there was like a 2-foot perimeter around her desk. And the kids pretty quickly, little kids, like 2 and 3 year olds, understood they were in a safe space. They're all in the basement together. They got tons of toys and playthings. And they understood that if they wanted to come talk to her, they needed to put their toes on the line just for 15 minutes at a time. And she would work in 15 minute bursts. And it was, you know, developmentally, it's good for kids to learn how to play on their own too. You know, there was nothing, you know, in no way was she not giving them the attention they needed. But she declared her boundaries and they listened. I would imagine it's much harder to do that with a newborn. The newborns get bigger very quickly. There are a lot of people who think that they can work without childcare because in the beginning, particularly if they haven't had a rough physical entry to motherhood, if they've healed pretty quickly, may feel like, oh, baby's napping a lot, I should be able to work. Well, your body is still recovering. Emotionally, you're still recovering. And, you know, and that baby, like the second that first nap drops, you're like, oh my goodness, like I have to very on with this child. So
totally.
As much as you can give yourself the benefit of childcare, do.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really helpful. I love what you say about, you know, be as good a boss to yourself as you wish a good boss would be.
Yes. And that includes taking vacation as much as you can, you know?
Yep. Totally. Actually thinking about physical recovery. So for me, my tailbone broke during my delivery.
Me too.
Oh really?
God, me too.
Did you have a forceps delivery?
Say that again?
Did you have a forceps delivery?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
No,
still broke. Well,
it was vaginal, but this was my first son. It was, to be totally honest, I had an epidural that was probably almost too good and I couldn't feel how hard I was pushing.
Well, so you know the pain of the broken tailbone and how
I do.
Long it lasts.
Sitting, getting up from sitting is the worst.
Exactly.
You know, when you're working, typing, sitting's what you're doing.
So yeah, like it literally took a year for mine to recover. So when I went back after 3 months, I was in excruciating pain. And it, you know, to your point, I'd be in a meeting and it would take me 5 minutes to get out of my chair.
Oh, and, oh my God, or going to the bathroom, sitting down. Oh my God.
Don't even get me started.
Like, terrible flashback.
So, you know, our situations are exceptional. Like most people, you know, are not breaking their tailbones. But we know the vast majority of first-time mothers who give birth vaginally tear. And if not that, then you've had a C-section and that healing time is different for, you know, everyone in both cases, but, you know, birth is brutal and the recovery is brutal. And I'm just curious, you know, in terms of being at pain at work, how do you think women can best advocate for themselves with their bosses, knowing that it might be a sensitive subject to bring up for some
people? I think I've never actually been asked that question before, and it's such a good one. I've talked a lot about, you know, sort of emotional pain that you might feel if you're back before you're ready to be. But physically, I have to kind of draw a hard line. I have to say, if you are in physical pain at work that would improve if you were not at work, I do think it is worth talking to your doctor and figuring out if you can engage with your employer in some sort of additional disability beyond parental leave.
Yeah.
You know, even if it's just that, you know, you take a couple more hours in the morning to get out the door, whatever it is. So they have to legally, your employer in America has to at least engage with you for reasonable accommodations is the term, which is basically the idea that they have to work with you to make a plan that would allow you to eventually be able to do your job fully again.
Yeah.
Which is a nice way of thinking about it, because just like something like a fifth trimester, it is finite. You know, you're working together to figure out something that's going to let you do your job fully again. And so if you need to be accommodated for a little bit along the way, they have to engage with you in that.
Yeah.
And help you make it. So I would say, you know, I would absolutely make it, you know, a legitimate conversation about being accommodated in the workplace. That said, you know, there's a lot of physical needs around the return to work that aren't necessarily pain, but they're like, you need to pump. And maybe it does get painful if you're in a meeting and you haven't had the time that you need to pump. And I would say, you know, it depends on the workplace, clearly, but as comfortable as you can be bringing up these things, first of all, remember that, you know, the stuff that is physically about your body, everybody else is more uncomfortable about it probably than you are. So if you act comfortable and like this is a completely legitimate conversation to be having around my need to, you know, find a safe, quiet, and private space to pump breast milk 3 times a day for my child, you know, the first time you say breast, depending on your workplace, it may feel weird. The second time, it will not feel weird. And if you act like it's not weird, then they will feel permission to also act like it is not weird. They're taking their cues from you.
Yeah.
So I think that's the best advice I can give there around, even just around like needing a, like when you're pregnant, needing to sit closer to the bathroom for goodness sake.
Right, right. You know? Totally. Yes. That's really good advice. I wish I had, done that. Like looking back now at the pain I was in, you know, I felt like, oh, you know, I've just come back. Like, I don't want to, you know, kind of rock the boat and demand.
No, you don't want to be like Mia sitting on a donut, you know?
Yes. Oh, yes. And speaking of pumping and, you know, women who have chosen to, you know, continue to breastfeed when they go back to work, what's your recommendation for, you know, really being able to make the time to do that, especially for women who aren't necessarily in control of when meetings hit their calendar, right? Yeah. Or, you know, if they don't have a dedicated nursing room in their work environment, which is woefully many, what steps do you recommend that employees take to kind of initiate change in that culture that isn't putting new mothers' needs first?
Again, you know, so your workplace is actually, except for a few workers who are not covered by this law, they actually are required to provide you with a private space, you know, that is accessible for you to be able to pump in, but is not a bathroom. And also the time, although it doesn't have to be paid time, the time in your workday to do it. So that's just the bare legal necessity. And so if your workplace isn't hitting that, I always like to assume the best intentions. I don't think that, you know, people want to be drill sergeants, you know, and work their workers to death. No, it's not that. It's just that they might not know. So unfortunately, a lot of this education falls on, or educating, I should say, you know, falls on the poor mother's shoulders to do. But it can be very, confidence boosting when you ask for something like this to know that you're not doing it just for yourself. You're doing it actually to help protect your workplace legally and to help make it a more humane place for other parents to work as well.
Yes.
And so going into those conversations can be made a little easier when you think of it as like, this is not just something for me.
Exactly.
But it is actually something they should be providing for you. The other thing around pumping that I like to talk about, and this comes with the caveat that not everybody is able to work while they pump, depending on the kind of job you have, depending on just how easy a time you have pumping. But if you can work during that, you know, those 3 times a day is what on average the women I interviewed told me they were doing. It was taking about 20 minutes to do the actual pumping of like the milk coming out of your body. If you can work during that time, and you can ask for whatever setup you need to be able to do that work. Like maybe you do need a plug. Maybe you do need to be in a room that has Wi-Fi. Maybe you do need to be able to do, you know, phone calls while you do this. Don't just ask for those things. Then like when you come out of having done them, tell people you did them, because we need to destigmatize this idea that pumping is a break. It is absolutely not a break. You're doing 3 jobs. You're feeding your baby. You're doing your job. And you're changing workplace culture at the same time. And I think that's commendable.
Yeah, that's a really, really great way to think about it. I love that. So obviously I'm British, and when I was pregnant, I'd be speaking to my friends, you know, over there who were also pregnant, who would be taking, you know, a year, 39 weeks of which are paid. And in fact, you're not actually allowed to return to work before 2 weeks or 4 weeks if you work in a factory.
Right.
So I had quite a few moments where I was like, what the hell am I doing giving birth in the States?
I'm curious. No blame you.
Yeah, right. What culture is getting it right, in your opinion? Is there a utopia for working parents?
The closest we've got is Norway, where you can actually see the measures, not just of the time that moms and dads are taking, but also of the numbers of them who stay in their careers and the impact that they have on the GDP. And it's been measured and studied in a way that's pretty comprehensive and pretty convincing. And so it has changed cultural expectations around parenthood. That said, and this is another point at which I sort of changed my tune. You know, I do think that there is I think every woman should be able to define what works best for her and her family. Like that's sort of, you know, priority one. That said, I do think that it is possible to take too much parental leave to a point where it makes it actually harder for you to return. And we saw this with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation actually recently made a very bold move of cutting what had been a year-long parental leave policy down to 6 months. And I was really, really impressed that they didn't just sweep this under the rug, you know, as if it were something to be ashamed of. They actually explained their thinking and their logic behind it, which is that they looked at the data and they saw how many parents, women, I think in particular, are more likely to leave their jobs if they have been out more than 6 months, and to find the transition actually harder. 6 months is really the sweet spot. Or I guess it was not that they'd been out more than 6 months. It was that they had been out more than a year. It made it very hard. So what they did instead to compensate for that is they gave employees a $20,000 stipend to use toward childcare. Because the one area that has really benefited from having substantially more leave beyond 6 months is that newborn care and infant child care is the most expensive of all. Mm-hmm. So when a lot of women drop out of the workforce, it's because they simply can't afford, you know, they do the math on what their job pays them and then cut the taxes out of that and what they're netting, and then they have to pay that to a caregiver. It becomes less expensive the older your child gets. And so they were trying to, in making, you know, this policy change, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation was trying hard to accommodate for that. And so instead of giving parents a year's leave, they gave them 6 months paid leave, but then also the stipend to help with childcare. And I don't know for sure, but I would be shocked if they did not also have an on-ramping return program that lets parents work part-time hours, at least initially, to ramp back in.
Right. Yeah, that's fascinating. And really great to your point that they were really open about this. And
Well, so much, I mean, everything they do is based on research, right? And so I've learned, you know, as a reporter and a journalist, it's an amazing thing to be able to hang your hat on numbers that have been, you know, really vetted by scientists.
This podcast is called The Unmentionables because we want to explore those topics that aren't discussed as much in relation to the fourth trimester as we feel that they should be. So I asked Lauren, what are some of the biggest unmentionables she sees in relation to the fifth trimester?
Oh, that's so interesting. I mean, I think that some of it is a physical adjustment to pumping. If you're pumping, if you have a baby who has been breastfed at home and hasn't gotten used to a bottle, oh my God, that is devastating to have a baby who doesn't take a bottle. There's that. A lot of women, and I don't have a statistic to give you, but a lot of women are obviously still physically healing at the 3 month mark, particularly if they've had a C-section. Mm-hmm. There can be complications, you know, with the incision. You know, lifting things can be hard depending on what kind of job you have. Again, bladder control, if you haven't gotten, you know, in the United States, pelvic therapy after birth is not like commonly done and commonly prescribed. So if you haven't gotten that can be an issue. And then also postpartum mood disorders. A lot of them don't show up until months and months after you've had this baby. So you have your initial bout of, I'm crying a lot because it's the first couple weeks and this is like crazy adjustment. But, you know, then you may be okay. But then perhaps something like going back to work or not having the support you need around these transitions can make you more vulnerable to postpartum depression, postpartum anxiety. You probably aren't sleeping yet. The women who I surveyed said on average they were sleeping 7 nights straight, like adult night sleep, mm-hmm. By the 7 month mark postpartum. So this is a lot of what's physical that's going on with the mom when she's back at work before, you know, her body is necessarily ready to be there.
Yeah, I think that's great because, you know, so many people don't realize that those postpartum mood disorders can happen later. I think that's so
absolutely
important to, you know, continue to communicate.
Well, and it's also kind of, I think, for a lot of new parents, particularly moms who aren't being seen until a 6 week checkup, you know, you've been into your pediatrician, and your pediatrician asks how you doing, and that may not be enough. And you may feel, you may feel like something is wrong inside, and that if you reveal that, you know that you're gonna, your instinct is to protect your baby. And if you think in any way you may lose access to your baby, like that is gonna keep you from feeling like you could be open.
Yes, yes. Okay, is there anything else that we haven't touched on that you'd like to share?
Oh, you know, everything. No, I'm teasing. Just, you know, it does get easier. It gets different. You know, and I like to tell women that, you know, there are so many ways that motherhood makes you actually more valuable in your workplace. Some of that is about staying in the pipeline and the actual statistics and numbers we have around companies that have more women in leadership positions, both in executive roles or on their corporate boards. We know that that actually pays off. The issue is convincing yourself and convincing your workplace that giving you the resources you need in this finite transition will ultimately let you stay in. So there's that, but it's also just understanding the ways that you do become more flexible, more creative, more definite when you say yes to things. You know, a lot of moms like to say, oh, I got better at saying no after I, you know, went back to work because I was trying to do the math in my head about whether or not I should say yes or no to this thing. And I say no so much better now. Well, what I like, that's great. But I like to tell moms, like, also remember you're better at saying yes, because when you do say yes, that is probably a more meaningful yes than you've ever given before. Because if you've decided to go and have that networking drink after work, or to, you know, work on a project that's a stretch for you or something, if you take that on and you say yes, you've already done the internal calculations of what you're going to have to steal time away from to be able to do that. So really, really embrace that. Moms also like to say that they are more efficient, and they are, because most of us anyway, our days have a harder stop at the end of them than they ever have had before. Mm-hmm. And yes, you're more efficient, but it's interesting to understand why, which is that you actually compress the time that you take between tasks. So it's not just that you're more efficient and you're doing, you know, less in that time. It is actually that you don't need as much transition time between the tasks, and you can just pivot. Because I believe, I haven't actually seen research that shows this, but at least in my own research and what I've learned from the women I've interviewed, your baby teaches you that. Your baby is an incredibly demanding boss who isn't going to wait around while you transition between tasks, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, with a couple quick months of training, you come back to work like pretty able to turn on a dime, you know?
Yes, you're exercising that muscle.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the biggest takeaway.
Thank you.
Yeah.
This is, of course, such great, really actionable advice. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me on, and for the great work you guys are doing supporting new moms. It matters so much.
Yeah, thank you. You too. And yeah, we look forward to just seeing what else you're getting up to.
You too. All right. Great talking to you.
Right,
thank
care,
you so
Lauren.
Much.
Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
So I'm in the studio with Eden and Aubrey, Niece's other co-founders, and we're going to roll right into our unmentionable section of the podcast. This is where we invite you, our listeners, to call in or email us with any questions or comments or anything that you'd like to share about your postpartum experience. We'll play it and discuss. You can call 336-HI-NISA and leave a voicemail, or email us at hello@nisacare.com. A reminder that we're not medical professionals. We're three new mothers who want to help change the postpartum conversation. That said, if you have a question that requires an expert opinion, we do have a number of doulas, midwives, OBGYNs, therapists, and pediatricians in our extended network that we can certainly tap for their perspective too. So don't hold back. We'd love to hear all of your questions and stories. So we have a voicemail for today. Let's play it.
Hi, Nisa. This is Susie Bucaro calling. Birth stories. I love birth stories. I used to watch a show called Baby Story on TLC when I was pregnant. Every time I have a friend who has a baby and I'm meeting the baby for the first time, I ask them to tell me the birth story. I find them heartwarming and interesting, and having all of the like important parts of a story, like there's a climatic, exciting ending, and there's the, you know, the emotional experience of my friend who was a part of the story. I mean, I find them very valuable. I had a conversation with a coworker who's a male, and he said to me that he thought birth stories were self-indulgent and boring. And I started thinking back about my past experiences where I interacted with new moms and their partners. And for the most part, like, dad doesn't weigh in on the birth story. Like, he has nothing to say. And he doesn't even seem interested, maybe because he's heard it 1,000 times. Oddly, as mom is telling the story, she seems to be reliving it, feeling all the emotions and very excited to talk about it. And I'm wondering, like, why my friend who said it was self-indulgent was like, do you like if someone were to, if you're at a party and someone's like, oh, do you want to hear about my ACL surgery? And you're like, not really. I mean, it's boring. And I'm thinking, is this how men, like, do men feel this way because they feel left out? Because they didn't have a part to play in the actual birth other than being a bystander? Is that why? Is this a sense of, like, jealousy? So I have no part in this story. I did nothing but watch. But it's the birth of your child. Like, it's different than ACL surgery. Like, it's how your child, a person you will love, or maybe you do love now, came into the world. And you find it to be self-indulgent and boring? I don't know. I think that there's something to be talked about there.
Hi, this is Aubrey again, co-founder of NISA, and I'm here with Eden.
Hi, y'all.
So we just wanted to thank this lovely caller for sort of voicing some of her experiences. And it's a really interesting topic and question.
Absolutely. It's interesting thinking about it specifically as a birth story and then also comparing that to the idea of experiential story. So when I was listening to the call, the first thing I thought of is how I hate hearing people's dreams. And then you're like at a party and you're like, I had this dream yesterday, and I'm like, yawn. And I immediately am trying to find like my getaway and how I can get back to like the buffet line. But with birth stories, when I gave birth to my son, in preparation for it, I kept asking all these questions. I kept asking people who had experienced it before, like, what's the pain feel like? What do you mean when you say push? There's so many versions of push. How do I practice pushing in advance? And not too hard, because I know I'm not supposed to do that. But, like, what did you experience? What did you feel? How did it – you're there for 30 hours, so, like, what are you doing for 30 hours? And I kept asking and asking and asking and YouTubing and Googling, and there was this common thread, right? Not remembering. It was difficult. It was hard. It hurt. And then you forget it all. And I rebelled against that. I wanted to remember every detail. It felt like it was my job to pass that on. And I had friends that were pregnant and friends that newly had babies, and I wanted to talk about it because we would talk about anything. So I really wanted to talk about it. And I think it was a priority for me to really discuss my birth story. And listening to that call, I realized that I probably talked about it with a lot of people that might not have wanted to listen. And I probably did not ask, do you want to hear my birth story? I think I immediately launched into a diatribe about my vagina and that I probably didn't give a lot of warning. But I would almost venture to say, I don't necessarily think that pushback on listening or being engaged in the conversation has to do with gender. I think it's experience. It's not the same to me as ACL surgery. It's the same as being hit by a bus. It is trauma. And I wanted to talk to people about it because I had never, in all the injuries that I've had and the experiences I've had, I've been hit by cars twice riding my bicycle. I had never experienced that level of trauma. And so I was like, holy cow, you guys, let me tell you. And I have to tell you because I know that biologically I'm supposed to forget. So I want to just talk about it.
That's kind of ironic as well, because I think that part of your compulsion to speak about it was to really prepare other people, where at the same time you can't ever really be prepared for other reasons, but also because they're just things that you can't understand until
you've experienced it. Like, how do you prepare for getting hit by a bus?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
No, it's really fascinating. Do you ever find that there – so now it's been, what, 2 years uh-huh. since you gave birth. Uh-huh. How has that compulsion to continue to tell your story changed? And is there sort of like any sort of audience considerations? Are there people that you're really excited to tell your story to and people that you just think maybe aren't worth the effort?
No, you're totally right. It has shifted. I think – now, well, I think 2 years later, I've gotten a little less, my bubble or my headspace has expanded a bit. So now I'm a little bit more attentive to, is this a good story? Is this something that's compelling for other people? I don't necessarily judge that it's not, that it's going to land flat if a person hasn't experienced their own birth story. But it's more, is it appropriate? And then my delivery. So I'll go into certain detail, or I'll use more colorful language to really accentuate. I have noticed that. Mm-hmm. So I want it to be as interesting as telling them about like an art show that I was at, because it was that nuanced. It was trauma for sure, but it was also like crazy, and like there was like hilarious moments. And even while I was pushing, I watched a lot of movies that I would never watch, like Jurassic Park. So telling that
you watched Jurassic Park while you were giving,
I did. Me and my partner.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And it was a pretty good movie. Like I remember it now, looking back, is like that was like pretty entertaining. But like every, I don't know, because I didn't really pay attention that I should have, but like every 3 minutes, 7 minutes, whatever it is, I would be like, ugh, and I'd like be like, rewind, like, because I missed it.
Quick tangent. Have you watched Jurassic Park since?
No, God. I probably will like immediately hurt.
Just have contractions. Yeah. No, that's really fascinating. And I think, you know, one of the issues that I had is that I had so few people in my life that had children that were sort of in my peer group when I was pregnant. And so I was trying to kind of gather that information. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people from older generations, you know, didn't remember what that experience was like, for a few different reasons. I mean, obviously, I think the practice of giving birth and drugs that we use were a little bit different than they are today. But I think that not having sort of a bit of a roadmap or a bit of a I don't know, just again,
like what to expect.
Exactly. Was really difficult. And now I like to tell my birth story because I feel like it helps me remember it. That's how our memories work. Yeah.
100%. Mm-hmm. And you're right. You're also, I mean, you don't eat and you don't drink, and possibly there's, you know, drugs involved, and then there's also pain. So, I mean, just it's already set up, so it's very easy to forget. And so I am constantly reminding myself just how much it hurt, but also like the wonder of it, like how your body shifted and you felt your body shift and all the things that happened. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it is important to remember.
So as a takeaway from this discussion, Jurassic Park is recommended for...
I do, right, for like any like pain situations, just have it playing in the background.
All right. Well, thank you so much, caller, for calling in. We really appreciate everybody's perspective and would love to hear more about the unmentionables that are on your mind, those of you who are listening to the podcast. If you want to give us a call, we're not medical professionals, but we do like to talk about stuff. So if you have any thoughts about unmentionable experiences that you've had surrounding birth or, you know, sort of those new stages.
The journey into parenthood.
Mm-hmm, please give us a call at 336-HI-NISA. It's 336-HI-NISA. Thank you guys for listening.
Take care.
Okay, that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you can rate and review us on Apple Music, that would be amazing. We're just starting out and we'd love to hear your feedback. We're also currently crowdfunding to help support the release of our fourth wear underwear. That's our patent-pending postpartum comfort underwear designed to make the fourth trimester recovery easier for all birthing parents. If you're interested in learning more about fourth wear, you can visit ifundwomen.com and search for NISA, or check out the link in our show notes. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time. Go forth. The NISA podcast is recorded at Strange Magic Recording, produced and edited by Robbie Haynes and Tony Lazara. The theme music is by Electrolane.